I now call this remote meeting of the House Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division to order. So good to see you all. Thanks for being here. This is an informational hearing only. No action will be taken. We have three proposals on the table this morning, all in bill form. And the first one that we have on our agenda is the Rebuild Right Grant Program. Representative Lee is the author of that bill. Welcome to the committee. I think it's best to have House Counsel very briefly go over the bill because it is new for a lot of folks.
Hello, Dave. My name is Shelby James. I was curious about a possible pontoon rental for this weekend, specifically on Saturday. If you could please give me a call back.
There's something that was not us. Okay. If I would like House Counsel to go over the bill for a few minutes, and then we will hear from Commissioner Kelly, and then the Senior Strategic Initiatives Manager from the Lake Street Council. There are other folks who are available to answer questions and talk about this bill. So with that, Council, if you would help us out by going over the bill a bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill has three sections. The first section establishes what's called the Rebuild Right Program in the Department of Commerce, which is to provide financial assistance to owners of buildings that were damaged or destroyed during the civil unrest in May and June, and that funds are to be used to upgrade the energy systems of those rebuilt buildings. The second, I'll just summarize the sections and then go through them one by one. The second section allows for supplementary energy activities in residential properties that have received assistance under the Federal Weatherization Assistance Program. And finally, the third section appropriates money for these two purposes. Let's go back to Section 1, the Rebuild Right Grant Program. The first subdivision consists of a number of definitions that are used throughout the section. Subdivision 2 actually establishes the program in the Department of Commerce. Section 3 specifies what information is supposed to be in the application for the grants awarded under this section, including how what the applicant's experience is in doing programs of this type, how property owners will be notified that the program is available, what geographic area the grants are to be given out, and how applicants will determine whether proposed projects will meet the energy standards that are discussed later in the Act, and how applicants will evaluate and rank project proposals that come to them. I should say that this grant program is really kind of a two-step program. The Department of Commerce is making grants to organizations, which then will make specific grants to specific building owners. So it's a two-step process. And most of the bill concerns step one, the grants to the initial organizations. In subdivision 4 on page 3, it discusses what applicants are eligible to receive these grants. And we're looking for applicants that have experience analyzing the energy and economic impacts of installing technologies in buildings for conservation and renewable energies, and have worked with contractors to implement projects of that type, and who've also had experience successfully working with small businesses and community groups and residents of low-income neighborhoods. Subdivision 5 sets up the energy standards which buildings receiving grants under this section must meet. Paragraph A says the commercial and institutional buildings must meet the current sustainable building 2030 standards, energy performance standards. And subdivision B speaks to multifamily buildings that receive grants under this program must meet what's called the International Passive House Standard, or the U.S. Department of Energy's Zero Energy Ready Home Standard. Subdivision 6 says that the eligible properties for grants under this program are those that were damaged or destroyed during the civil unrest in May and June. And Subdivision 7 outlines the eligible expenditures for these grants, which includes, of course, outreach activities to potential grantees, purchasing and installing the energy measures, paying the reasonable costs of the department's administration costs, and finally compensating task force members of a task force that I'll talk about shortly. On page 4, Subdivision 8 lists the priorities which the commissioner is to establish in awarding grants, and those include a commitment to conducting aggressive outreach programs to provide assistance to eligible buildings. Also, those that commit to employing contractors that pay a prevailing wage are to receive a grant priority, and also organizations that leverage additional funding in addition to this grant are to be given priority. Subdivision 9 at the bottom of page 4 establishes what the funds can be used for, and they can be used to pay the difference in cost between renovating or constructing a building's envelope or energy system. The difference in those costs to meet current energy performance standards and the performance standards that I discussed earlier, either the 2030 building performance standards or those DOE or passive house standards, which of course are more stringent than the current standards. And what this program pays for is the difference between meeting those current standards and those more stringent ones established in the bill. Subdivision 10 discusses the awards to individual building owners and the information that must be in grants or in applications for that money. Subdivision 11 discusses information that grantees must provide to the Commissioner of Commerce, what properties have been awarded grants, what the funding level was, and what kind of energy measures were put into those buildings. Subdivision 12 constructs an advisory task force to advise the commissioner throughout the grant program. The commissioner appoints 8 members, including representatives of Xcel Energy, the Prairie Island community, and organized labor, representatives of organizations that are familiar with installing energy conservation measures in buildings, representatives from buildings or building associations located in areas that were damaged or destroyed. And at the top of page 6, you can see that the representatives and state senators from that are representing districts that were damaged or destroyed also appoint 2 task force members from residents who live in those neighborhoods. So there's 12 members of the advisory task force in total. And that group is to advise the commissioner throughout the process, including within 60 days of its initial meeting, making recommendations regarding the content of the request for proposal that gets sent out. And this group can also recommend additional funding priorities to the ones I discussed earlier. Finally, Subdivision 13 requires a report from the Commissioner of Commerce to the legislature outlining how much money has been spent and what kinds of energy measures they were spent on. Turning now to the top of page 7 is section 2. This is the section that uses funding to supplement the weatherization services from the Federal Weatherization Assistance Program. And it also allows the commissioner to, like the previous section, establish higher energy performance standards that this program can meet. And those were developed by the Department of Commerce. Finally, section 3 in the middle of page 7 is the appropriation for these programs. As you'll see on line 7.17, the total amount, excuse me, is blank right now, but 75% of the funds would be spent on the Rebuild Right grant program, and additional 20, and the remaining 25% on supplementing the weatherization services. And at the bottom of the page, in paragraph D, it specifies these funds can only be spent on buildings located in Xcel's electric service area. Madam Chair, that concludes my summary of the bill.
Thank you. I hope we're not having, okay. We're gonna have the Commissioner of Commerce and then Matt Kaczynka. We'll have questions, and then we'll have public testimony from Rick Evans. So if we can start with Commerce Commissioner Steve Kelly. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you, members, for giving me the opportunity to present the Rebuild Right Renewable Development Account proposal. For the record, my name is Steve Kelly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I want to start by thanking Representative Lee for authoring this important legislation. We've all heard the stories of property damage following the killing of George Floyd. Thousands of businesses and households were affected by this disaster. And we also know the issues are ongoing. Just this morning, we woke up to more reports of businesses damaged overnight in downtown Minneapolis in the wake of the shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Matt Kaczynka from the Lake Street Council is with us today and can speak to the effect on business owners in South Minneapolis next. When Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan asked agencies to look for resources to assist in the rebuilding efforts, the department saw an idea being proposed by the Center for Energy and Economy and Fresh Energy to use funds left in the RDA to help businesses rebuild more efficiently and with the possibility of adding more renewables in the mix. Over the past couple of months, the department has worked jointly with CEE and Fresh Energy to develop this idea. Department staff have also engaged in extensive outreach to a range of community organizations. The proposal before you today reflects that work and the insights gathered through many conversations with stakeholders, business associations, community organizations, and perhaps most importantly, community members and advocates. There is an estimated $55 million left in the RDA in fiscal year 21. After the legislature appropriated funding this past regular legislative session to the Prairie Island Indian Community's Net Zero Project, a hydro turbine refurbishing in Granite Falls, a host city grant program, and the extension of solar rewards. This proposal would use $45 million of the amount left available in fiscal 21 to aid both residential homeowners and commercial business owners. This proposal has two distinct focuses. First, to aid residents whose homes are in areas affected by the civil unrest, and a second that focuses on the businesses that need to rebuild. One third of the funding in this proposal, or about $15 million, would be allocated to residential programs. 75% of the residential funding will be allocated through the Federal Low-Income Weatherization Assistance Program for the installation of energy efficiency, renewable energy, and other innovative and health and safety measures in order to expand the scope of service and number of households served under the federal program. The advisory council that Mr. Eliff described that is established in this proposal will establish a list of qualifying measures for inclusion in the weatherization assistance program no later than 60 days after it is convened. And this list has to be reviewed and modified as needed by the department on an annual basis. The remaining 25% will be allocated through the competitive process that Mr. Eliff described for innovative energy improvement projects that meet national program standards, such as Passive House or the Department of Energy Zero Energy Ready Home. On the commercial side, grants will be awarded to incorporate qualified energy technologies as part of the renovation and new construction of buildings damaged or destroyed during the civil unrest. These remaining roughly $30 million of the total funding will go towards grants for programs to support commercial, business, or multifamily housing buildings, and rental units. To be a viable candidate for funding, businesses have to provide demonstrable benefits to tenants and assurance that funded improvements will not increase rent within a reasonable benefit time period. The department would make grants to eligible organizations or groups of organizations that would in turn make grants to individual projects. And in addition to criteria yet to be determined by the advisory council, the proposal requires granting priority be given to eligible entities that demonstrate a plan to successfully serve the identified community, business, or residents affected by the disaster, distribute funds within a census tract with at least 50% households having median household income at or below 60% state median income, be within a designated opportunity zone, or serve buildings that qualify as a multifamily building. Distribute funds through a competitive lottery or priority system, provide educational outcomes, prioritize minority and women-led businesses, pay contractors a wage to workers equivalent to the state prevailing wage, and leverage non-RDA funding that could come through public, private, or philanthropic resources, including but not limited to low-income loans or other grants from government entities or private financiers. Or develop innovative community-driven projects that meet national program standards, such as Passive House or the Living Building Challenge. One key element of this proposal, as Mr. Eliff described, is the creation of an advisory task force to assist the department throughout the request for proposal and grant award process. It is important that communities served by this proposal are involved in developing the criteria used for project award selection, as well as the project selection itself. The advisory task force includes, as Mr. I won't go over the list that Mr. Eliff has already described. Before I close, I would like to highlight that we're continuing to hold conversations as we make sure to develop a proposal that works best for the community and helping businesses rebuild. We do not view the conversations we've already had as one-time opportunities for input, and we'll continue to work with the communities as this bill evolves. One example of that is that you'll be hearing from Excel's testimony this morning with ideas on improvement for the bill. In addition, the American Institute of Architects has also provided feedback. We intend to keep working with stakeholders, industry, clean energy advocates, and community advocates to strengthen the proposal and advance this idea. We've already found a few areas of the bill that need technical updates and corrections, which can be addressed when the bill is able to receive formal action. We also intend to clarify that even though Prairie Island Indian Community has a representative on the advisory council, they would still be permitted to apply for funding if they qualify, but would recuse themselves from voting on their application. I hope this committee agrees that targeting the renewable development account funds on this program helps create the innovation and opportunity for cleaner and more efficient energy that the renewable development account was intended for. This proposal leverages federal, state, and local resources to provide grants for energy efficiency, renewable energy, and related grid improvements while supporting historically disadvantaged business and residents and prioritizing communities most affected by the devastating effects of the killing of George Floyd and the unrest that followed. Thank you for your time this morning, and Madam Chair, at the appropriate time, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Kelly. We will hear from Matt Kaczynka and from Representative Lee before we take questions. So now I would welcome Matt Kaczynka, Senior Strategic Initiatives Manager of the Lake Street Council. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Kaczynka. I'm representing Lake Street Council, a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. I want to thank you for inviting me to offer my testimony today in support of the proposed Rebuild Right Grant Program. The perspective I'll share is informed by the work that my colleagues and I have undertaken in the past 3 months to support small businesses that were impacted by the civil uprising that followed the murder of George Floyd on May 25th. Lake Street Council exists to support the businesses and organizations in the Lake Street corridor of Minneapolis. The Lake Street is a 6-mile commercial corridor that runs through some of the most diverse neighborhoods in our state. We estimate that there are approximately 2,000 businesses in the corridor, a majority of which are owned by people of color. The street has long been a home to immigrants, over 100 years ago, starting with the wave of Scandinavian immigrants and followed by groups of Greek, German, and other European immigrants who helped define Lake Street as a premier commercial corridor. Their legacy continues to today with the help of newer immigrant families from Latin America and East Africa. These businesses, along with those owned by our Black, Indigenous, Asian, and white community members, make Lake Street what it is. And our work at the council has always been multifaceted, ranging from marketing and advocacy to direct technical assistance with businesses. We see our role as a connector, helping small businesses learn about and access resources available to them. And normally, we have about a dozen different initiatives in operation to help bring people to Lake Street and ensure the success of our businesses. Of course, these aren't normal times, and many of our outreach programs were already in transition after the coronavirus pandemic reached Minnesota in March. They came to a screeching halt at the onset of the civil uprising. The tragic loss of George Floyd, followed by nights of protest and unrest that left hundreds of businesses in our corridor severely damaged, drove us to immediately focus on business recovery. We launched the We Love Lake Street fundraiser during the week of unrest in Minneapolis. And with generous gifts from individuals and companies around the country, we raised over $5 million in a matter of days. I'm happy to share we've now raised over $10 million to support businesses in crisis. While this funding far exceeded our expectations, it has only begun to meet the needs. We immediately dedicated half of that money towards grants to small businesses that were directly damaged. And to date, over 300 businesses have received grants of up to $25,000 each, totaling a commitment of approximately $5 million. I share this because our grant-making process allowed us to get a better understanding of our needs in this moment. I can share with you some of the data drawn from the grant applications of nearly 400 businesses who applied for funding, which I believe provides a substantial, if somewhat incomplete, view of the full scale of damages in our corridor. First, some background info on these businesses who applied. These were small businesses. 85% of the businesses employ 10 or fewer people. Together, though, they employ over 1,500 full-time employees and 1,000 part-time employees. These were local businesses. 50% of the applicants have a business owner who lived within Minneapolis, and over 92% of applicants had Minnesota-based ownership. These were very diverse businesses. 82% of the businesses who applied for funding are owned by someone who identifies as Black, Indigenous, a person of color, or as an immigrant. These were businesses who were dependent on the availability of affordable rental space. Although many of them had operated in the corridor for years, over 85% of them rented their space of operation. And finally, these businesses operated without much of a safety net. 55% of the businesses reported that they did not have any form of insurance to protect against damages. And many of those who did have insurance reported receiving only partial coverage, and in some cases, denial of coverage. Outside of insurance, for those who had it, 75% of applicants stated that they did not have any other forms of support aside from our grant. We learned a great deal about the impacts that the civil unrest had on these businesses. Damages were extremely significant, extending far beyond the financial support we've been able to provide. In total, applicants reported over $36 million in damages and losses. And that's just the folks who applied for funding. Okay. Despite this, businesses are doing their best to get back open. Somewhere between half and three quarters of the businesses have found a way to reopen, often with the help of grants. However, many businesses remain closed, especially those who operated in a building that was completely destroyed, of which there were dozens. We focused on helping businesses get reopened so they can bring in income and provide the essential services that our community needs. My colleagues are out on the street every day providing multilingual assistance, helping people source building materials and equipment and compare bids from contractors. I believe our work has accelerated the recovery process, but there's so much left to be done. And if we're to ensure that the recovery is equitable, more public resources must be put on the table and made available to our community. I'd like to focus now on the proposal at hand. I believe strongly that energy efficiency and renewable energy can and should be a core part of the recovery process. And this proposal will help put vital resources where they are most needed in this moment. For a small business association, we're pretty uniquely familiar with energy efficiency programs. Over the past 5 years, we've worked closely with Energy Smart, a program of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, to help hundreds of businesses in the Lake Street Corridor get utility-funded energy assessments and technical assistance. And dozens of those, we've helped make improvements that have helped save businesses energy. We've also formed the Minnesota Small Business Energy Initiative with our partners at the Great Plains Institute, which has brought together experts from utilities, business associations, and municipalities to explore how we can expand small business energy efficiency in our communities. I'll share my perspective on the relevance of energy efficiency to our businesses in this particular moment. First of all, we know that many of these businesses are going to be purchasing and installing equipment that uses energy. Of course, in the buildings that will be rebuilt, there's no question that energy is going to be a core part of the process of designing and building those commercial spaces. In addition to that, approximately one third of applicants to our grant told us that they were seeking assistance to buy equipment that uses energy in their process of reopening their business. Whether they're replacing a single AC unit or a full building HVAC system, there are going to be opportunities for them to make a choice about efficiency. These businesses are also going to need help addressing deferred maintenance. In the years that I've been working to help businesses do energy efficiency, I've seen many of the larger projects take years to get done. Business owners need time to save and set aside the capital it takes to replace an aging HVAC unit or retrofit an entire lighting system. Of course, now any savings these businesses had has gone into their emergency recovery efforts. So deferred maintenance is going to be a bigger problem than ever. Finally, these businesses already had significant barriers to access energy efficiency resources, even before all of this. Business owners who operate on a subsistence basis, who navigate the system with English as their second language, who rent their space, these folks were already more likely than not using old, inefficient equipment, and they were much less likely to be aware of utility programs than many of their peers. They were already behind the curve on energy efficiency. This program, I believe, can address not just the current crisis, but also focus resources where they've long been needed. In our work, we've learned a lot about what works and what doesn't when designing commercial energy efficiency programs and the strategies to implement them. In general, we found that a one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work very well. This program would allow for the development of flexible, community-based approaches that could overcome the most significant barriers for small business energy efficiency in communities like ours and Lake Street. From my perspective, new programs must be able to incorporate the following elements to be successful. Outreach programs have to be founded on partnerships with trusted local organizations and individuals. To get buy-in from business owners, you need a trusted connection to get in the door and be taken seriously. Local business associations, economic development organizations, community-based nonprofits, all of them can provide that foot in the door. The closer the program is to the ground, the more it is going to be accepted by our community members. These programs must also be easy to participate in. Even before all of this, it was really very hard to get a business owner to spend time focusing on energy efficiency. The business owners who are in crisis now will need programs to earnestly meet them where they are and do the legwork on behalf of the business owner. It's especially true for entrepreneurs who fit the profile of many on Lake Street, those who speak limited English, who have limited education, and like many of us, have limited understanding of how building systems work. Finally, these programs must reduce upfront costs as much as possible and avoid asking businesses to take on new debt. Even in normal times, these small businesses are strapped for cash, overloaded on debt, and often required to compromise value for the sake of affordability. Now, given the immense costs many of them have just shouldered, we can't expect them to seek anything other than the options that are most affordable in the moment. If we want them to choose efficient equipment, it must come with a cost that is meaningfully lower than the alternatives. My final comments here, I just want to recognize that the testimony I provided is focused on Lake Street, but I believe our needs are relevant to the other vital and diverse community corridors like West Broadway and University Avenue and Midway St. Paul. And we're working in coalition with these organizations to support businesses in their districts. I'd also share that many businesses and community members are worried that Lake Street and communities like it are at risk of losing the diverse small businesses that make it special. Any fast, generous, and targeted activity to help these businesses make it through this crisis will keep that from happening. We know that folks want to stay and they want to reopen their business. This program gives them one more tool to do that. Madam Chair, committee members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective on this program and how it will benefit our community. I'll be available for questions if that is appropriate. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your testimony. Representative Lee is with us. Representative Lee, would you wish to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for the opportunity to present the Rebuild Right Grants Program. And I just want to say thank you to members of the committee for coming down to my district and to visit other parts of Minneapolis and St. Paul to really see some of the aftermath of the civil unrest and what we can really do to work together to help these communities recover. And just want to say thank you to Commissioner Kelly and Matt for their testimony and really engaging with public, private, and all of that to see what can we do to help out these communities. And I think that this program is really needed right now, because the issue that we're facing, it's a issue of equity, where these communities that were impacted by the civil unrest and have not traditionally been able to tap into some of these energy efficiency and some of these renewable that we really talked about. And so whatever we can do at the state level to help provide the resources for the community to recover, I think it's really needed. And for these businesses, Matt really hit the point where they are from communities of color, indigenous communities, and immigrant family members, similar to my own background. And so whatever we can do to make the bill stronger, like Commissioner Kelly has said, and incorporate feedback from everyone, from community, from stakeholders, I think that that's the right path forward. And so just want to say thank you again, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present it.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I don't see any hands raised, so we will go to public testimony now. And Rick Evans from XL Energy has signed up to testify. Welcome, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Commissioner Representative Lee. I have a small dog barking in the background. I hope no one else can hear it. I think I can get through this in spite of that, but I apologize. Must be a squirrel outside or something. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill today. XL Energy does support using RDA funds for renewable and efficiency projects. And we also recognize that rebuilding properties that have been damaged or destroyed in the past year offers an opportunity to apply what we know about renewable energy and efficiency to customers who are in a unique and unfortunate situation. In XL Energy's current conservation program, in fact, we are already working on with our partners to find new ways to serve in this same community. We think properly designed, a new program could put additional resources to that purpose. At the same time, we have some concerns about the structure of the program as contained in the bill. Would look forward to working with Representative Lee, Commissioner Kelly, and others as the bill moves forward, and would offer the following suggestions for improvement. First and foremost, we think the bill does not provide enough public accountability for the use of the money. Under the bill, the Department of Commerce would make grants to private entities based on a set of criteria that would not evaluate specific projects to be undertaken or tangible societal benefits, but rather on the aggressiveness of their proposed outreach and the nature of the neighborhoods they'll be targeting. Outreach and targeting are important, but they're by no means the only criteria for selecting grantees. Once selected, these private entities would solicit and evaluate proposed projects from building owners, making expenditures on those projects, and report to the public body only after the money has already been spent. This is a departure from the past, when either the Public Utilities Commission or the legislature would play a role in approving actual projects in advance of the money being spent, and removes an important point of accountability for the expenditures. If the money is to be granted to these grantees in advance of actual projects being chosen, we urge the legislature to require grantees to return to the Department of Commerce to get approval for the actual proposed expenditures after the projects have been chosen, but before the money has been spent. Second, we believe the legislation should more clearly state the criteria for selection of projects. Not every project within a geographic area should be deemed equal to all others. The legislation gives no guidance to the Department of Commerce or the eventual grantees as to how competing projects should be evaluated. For example, should the program value projects that get the most energy efficiency for the dollars expended? Should it apply the usual analysis of cost and benefit that goes in current efficiency programs? Should it favor building owners who owned the building before the damage or destruction, or are they to be treated equally with a developer who comes in to buy the building after the property was already damaged? Should there be an effort to determine how much of the additional value flows to the business owner or resident, as opposed to the contractor or the provider of renewable and efficiency services? Should societal benefits be a factor? None of these are addressed in the legislation. We believe the legislation would be improved by laying out in statute for the department and the grantees the sort of proposals that should be chosen for the use of these funds. Third, the bill is silent on the ability of project developers to use multiple XL Energy or public programs to accomplish the same project. XL Energy already runs a very robust conservation improvement program that helps customers make their homes and businesses more energy efficient. The program is supervised by the Department of Commerce, and that financial help is at the appropriate level that provide and ensured to provide value. It's not clear whether this new program would allow a greater level of support for some customers, whether that greater support really adds value over the SIP support that might be put to the same project. In the same way, XL Energy runs its solar rewards program under the supervision of the PUC. That program subsidizes solar installations at a level determined by the PUC to be appropriate for this market. Would this new RDA expenditure subsidize the same projects, but to a greater degree? And how would it be determined how that money should be spent and where it's going? Who would get the benefit of that added subsidy, and who determines if it's an efficient use of the money? The bill is silent on these important issues. We believe that projects given grants under this program should either be excluded from similar programs offered to the same properties, or that there be some additional oversight and analysis of the manner in which the programs are combined to make sure that it's done efficiently and will accomplish the same thing. Finally, with respect to the advisory task force, we would recommend that the membership reflect the broader community of XL Energy customers and stakeholders who, after all, are the real source of this money. The advisory task force should provide advice to the department from this broader point of view. The advisory task force described in the bill does not sufficiently represent the views of the XL Energy customers who are contributing the funds. We hope these are seen as constructive suggestions. We look forward to working with Representative Lee and Commissioner Kelly and others as this bill moves forward. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. I do see questions coming now, and the first one is from Representative Baker. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have a question for Matt. Mr. Evans kind of asked a lot of questions that I thought was appropriate, because I think some of those involved what I was going to ask. I think the current SIP program that we have in place is designed for something just like this. So this almost seems like a SIP program super modified on steroids. And I want to make sure that that does get addressed. And I hope that those recommendations from XL get sort of looked at by Representative Lee as this bill kind of moves along. But maybe my question for Matt, who kind of is involved with the Lake Street project, with still a lot of the unrest in the metro Minneapolis area, Matt, I'm curious, can you tell me, I hear rumors, I hear things out in rural Minnesota that folks are still uncomfortable rebuilding in an area that they don't feel quite stable, that is stabilized yet from a public safety standpoint. Maybe they're moving a little bit more to the metro, maybe moving away a little bit, still maybe in an XL Energy zone. But Matt, can you tell us what the tone is? Have you taken a survey of the current owners? Are they planning on rebuilding? Is there overwhelming commitment to moving forward with this? Because again, I think using our current ownership structures versus allowing some big developers to come in and take advantage of this might be not the intention of this to have these energy savings. But I just want to get an update from Matt as to what they're seeing in the desire and the intent to rebuild those businesses after the rioting and the unrest. Can you give us that update, please?
Mr. Kazinka.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for the question. So when we did our grant and we received data from 400 plus businesses, the universal response to our question about whether people plan to reopen in Lake Street was yes, we do plan to open and reopen here on Lake Street. Now, there are some factors that complicate that process for some folks. We are aware of some businesses who may be moving temporarily to a new location while they wait for their building to be rebuilt. I would say the furthest I hear of most people moving is Franklin Avenue, about a mile away. So there is very much an intent of businesses in our community to stay and to help rebuild. I hear a lot of enthusiasm and energy about that. Certainly it is tampered by anxieties. You know, people have been through a traumatic experience and there are concerns that linger about the security of their business or, you know, emotions that arise about, you know, things that may reopen the wounds that they experience. But I am honestly quite surprised that I have heard of very few instances of a businesses saying, that's it, I've thrown in the towel. You know, if I am opening my business, I'm definitely not opening it on Lake Street. It is possible that there is more of that that feeling that is not filtering up to us as the Lake Street Council. But what we hear broadly is an energy and interest and desire to stay in the corridor as much as possible.
Thank you. And just a quick follow-up, if I could. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is a question for Commissioner Kelly. Commissioner, you had mentioned the grants are going for the increases of the new efficiency standards. If a business, for example, will spend $100,000 on a current standard, can you tell us roughly what a percentage increase might be for, you know, current standard versus the new 2030 standard, so we know how much of that increase will come from this grant? I'm just kind of looking for some rough numbers if they exist.
Commissioner Kelly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I regret I can't give you a specific percentage at this point. My understanding is that, especially as architects and contractors get more familiarity with more aggressive energy saving measures and new technologies develop, sometimes what people have thought of as significant cost differentials have actually gone down with experience with these energy-saving technologies. So I'd be hesitant to suggest at this point that there's any sort of standard or quantifiable percentage difference between, say, today's building standards and, for example, what the SB 2030 standard would provide. We can work to see if the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research has data on that. They assist us with the SB 2030 standards process.
Representative Baker, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, and maybe to that. So what you're saying, Commissioner, is if energy, new technology can save improvements and infrastructure changes, many businesses may not be able to use this because if they can buy it cheaper, they wouldn't be eligible. Is that how that would ultimately work if the costs are going to be less?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, yes, if the capital cost of the additional energy saving measures is actually less than standard, then we would not expect that this program would need to incentivize or subsidize that. What we do anticipate is that there's typically some additional cost, but what I can't do for you today is quantify what that additional cost is on a percentage basis.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo is next. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lee, it's good to hear your voice. It's always nice when we have respected legislators before our committee who take the business of legislating seriously. And I say that because that's literally the only positive thing I can say about this bill. So is your authorship, is that you're involved in this. This bill at this time demonstrates a stunning level of tone deafness to be heard before this committee. We are in the midst of unprecedented riots in the city of Minneapolis. There've been 51 homicides in the city of Minneapolis this year, 51, more than all of last year combined. We are facing a pandemic which is fundamentally realigning the economic and business models of the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have entire industries that are premised on the basis of consumers going to work, working in downtown Minneapolis, purchasing products and services, and then returning to those homes. Workers are not going downtown. We have a convention center that is premised on hospitality traffic and convention traffic that's not coming back. We're in the midst of these crises, and the day after we have had some of the worst rioting in Minnesota history, the solution we're hearing before us today is we're going to focus on putting solar panels on the burned up rooftops of these buildings. This is insane. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Members, Representative Long is on the list. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Representative Garofalo's passion, but I passionately disagree with him. I think that when we have a crisis before us, like the one that we've faced with businesses in our central business districts that have been severely damaged, then I think we all can agree as a committee and hopefully across party lines that we should come together and help rebuild. We've done that time and time again across the state in many circumstances from many different businesses and many different types of emergencies. And that's what we come together to do as Minnesotans, is rebuild and help our neighbors when they're in trouble. And these businesses are in trouble. And I think that we, as the Energy Committee, don't have the purview to solve every problem, but we have some funding that is meant to go towards energy efficiency and renewable energy. And I think if we're going to deploy those resources, then it makes a lot of sense to do those, to help those most in need. And those most in need right now are the businesses that have been damaged in our community. So I appreciate Representative Lee bringing this bill forward. I appreciate the leadership of the Commerce Department in presenting this idea, and I'm hopeful that we can move forward with it.
Thank you, Representative Long. You are reminding me of votes I have taken. Normally, when bad things happen, Minnesotans come together, and I am recalling Rushford and Red River Valley flooding. And even though I knew without doubt that actions in those communities had made the situation worse, I voted for the money they needed to come back. I see this as a similar situation, and I appreciate Representative Long, you're making that point. Representative Swazinski is next. Representative Swazinski, there are three amendments that we have to this bill. We're not going to take formal action, but we put them up there for discussion purposes. So I was going to call on you to bring these up, but I see you next on the list. So Representative Swazinski for comments or to start talking about the amendments that are proposed. Yes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd kind of like to start just with some questions, and either can go to nonpartisan staff or the author of the bill. And just wanted to see, does this bill, you know, it seems like a little bit targeted, you know, with the peaceful protests from last night, would this be allowed to work in those particular areas in downtown as well, or is it only in other areas?
I would ask Commissioner Kelly to respond to that. Commissioner Kelly, you are. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, of course, at the time that we were drafting this bill, we did not anticipate the additional damage that occurred last night And so I think that's one of the questions to address as this bill moves forward. Our focus was on those communities that were affected by the unrest earlier this year. So we'd be happy to discuss with you and with the author whether the scope of the bill should be expanded. I do want to say, with respect to the question of scope, I hope that the legislature does approve this proposal and that we establish some track record in approaching grants for rebuilding in this fashion. Because as Chair Wagenius points out, there are and will be other examples of disasters in other parts of Minnesota. And if through this appropriation we can demonstrate the success of this program in the areas that have been affected by the civil unrest, we could also then in future years have a conversation with the legislature about using RDA funds to rebuild better in other parts of the state that are affected by natural or other disasters that require rebuilding or renovation as a result of the disaster.
Representative Straczynski.
So if the bill, so I'm not really familiar. It's my, from the estimates, it's going to remove about $45 million from the RDA fund. Am I correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Straczynski, that is the current proposal, yes.
So what would be the increase asked from the RDA, Madam Chair, or Commissioner Kelly, if you are to open it up to other areas affected by what's going on continually in Minneapolis?
Commissioner Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Straczynski, I think the conversation about how far, if at all, to expand the scope of the current proposal really depends on what this committee and the author, as well as obviously interactions with the other body, would involve. So I don't think I said anything that proposes that we would have an ever-evolving scope. I think the legislature, when it hopefully adopts this bill, would set the scope, and then through future legislation, if appropriate, broaden it in the way I suggested to potentially cover other geographic areas of the state and other kinds of disasters.
Representative Straczynski. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. And this would be a question maybe to the folks that maybe helped design this bill, to Fresh Energy or to the rest. You know, it seems like this proposal is closely resembling programs that already exist and using other funding sources, TIP and whatnot. Are you not, you know, going after these businesses currently or not? I mean, it seems like these things are already exist. Is there not the adherence to these programs where they're currently, I mean, obviously those are statewide potential programs for TIP. Are they just simply not applying in these areas? And to the other comment that I heard from the Lake Street, I just read the news article today. One of the businesses that was burnt last night said that they're no longer even safe to open up, even if they hadn't gotten burned down last night. So the folk that the fact that businesses are not talking about this, that aren't considering really what they're going to do, where they're going to open up, even if they will open up, you know, I think that's a real, real conversation and should be part of any sort of recovery conversation that we're having.
Representative Straczynski, I know that Justin Fay from Fresh Energy is on the line with us, and I would ask him if he would unmute himself and respond, if that's okay.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Justin Fay with Fresh Energy. Representative Swedzinski, to your question, certainly there are existing utility programs that are providing critical services to some of the same areas and communities that we've been discussing. Xcel Energy has been very proactive, their proposal to the commission. And we see the opportunity of unexpended revenue in the renewable development account as a worthwhile and useful supplement to those existing programs, which I think, you know, we all recognize we're not designed for disaster relief. It's not a core function of the SIP program, and I think it would be challenging for the folks who implement SIP programs at Xcel and their peer utilities to be able to, you know, spin on a dime and leverage those existing programs for these kind of unique circumstances. So that's been our thinking and approach.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just since he's still on the line, maybe could I just speak to one of the amendments and to probably, well,
yes,
maybe I'll just skip it, but you know, I'm going to make a general comment too. You know, I mean, we're not only dealing with the aftermath of the rioting and the looting, but we're also dealing with the aftermath of COVID-19 and the business's impacts that are really braced across the state, across, quite frankly, all of Xcel Energy, all of the cooperatives across the state and the rest. And, you know, those funds, particularly with the RDA, you know, are out of the businesses that are affected by that, whether they've had their businesses burnt down, whether they had their businesses shut down through COVID. And, you know, if we're really looking for relief, if we're really looking for opportunity to target businesses that are under duress for whatever reason, I think lessening their bill and simply either putting a pause to the RDA collection of these funds or actually just returning this $45 million in the pockets of business owners, whether they're on Lake Street or Lion Street, really, I think, would best benefit folks from across the state because guess what? We've got really diverse issues across the state and how they've been affected by COVID-19, the riots, and putting dollars actually back in the pockets of those who actually pay it, I think will better stimulate our economy across the state and especially in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where they really need it.
Thanks, Representative Swedzinski. Did you want to talk about the other two amendments or?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to have this. I want to thank Representative Lee for bringing this idea forward. I think it takes unique ideas to kind of come up with. Obviously, there's a lot of healing to happen and things to do. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think folks from Xcel really spoke well. Really, a lot of the fundamental issues with this bill, the potential cost to the Department of Commerce to come up with a brand new plan, and also the change in dynamic on how these funds will actually get spent. Rather than have prior approval, we'll simply be given notice. You know, this is a big chunk. You know, Representative Haley worked diligently on getting money for the folks down in Red Wing for the nuclear power plant with the community down there. And we were told at that point in time that when they asked for a dollar amount very similar to this, over $40 million, that it was inappropriate to be spending all that money on one particular geographic small area, and that we should spread it out over a period of time, not just take that. And so when we see a large amount going out again, how that's going to affect it, and having groups that outside will simply be notifying the legislature on how these dollars are spent. We need to be reining in the executive branch. We need to be reining in dollars that are being spent from outside groups, get it back to the legislature, not going the other way. So that's obviously one of the major flaws of this bill. But on top of that, these three amendments really want to focus in on some of the drastic issues that I think most folks that would agree that if you're actually trying to get a vast majority of projects done, trying to expend the dollars so that you can affect as many businesses as possible, the three amendments really would talks about the prevailing wage, mentioning prevailing wage. That'd be the A1 amendment. The A2 amendment would really remove language allowing political subdivisions to receive grants. So, you know, obviously, if the goal is to help a business, then the business should be the ones getting the grants, not another government entity that's going to have some staff person siphon off a bit of the money for themselves so that they can create FTEs and the rest. And then the A3 finally would really eliminate and speaking to the fact that, you know, these programs already exist, that you shouldn't be allowed to double dip. You shouldn't be able to allow, if this bill would move forward, that it would fundamentally keep you within a certain guardrail to say, hey, you know what, this program is dedicated for this particular area, use it. You know, don't come across a state and double dip, multiple dip, and keep those things tracked, because once a grant is out, it's going to be awfully hard to bring it back in. And so those three amendments really, whether it be the FIT program or the solar reward program, for the A3 amendment. And, you know, I appreciate Representative Lee for bringing this bill forward. I think we, obviously there's work, there's businesses across the state, but particular feel for your community.
Thank you, Representative Straczynski. I don't see anybody else listed on raised hands. So we are going to go on to House File 4172. With Representative Lisligard. Representative Lisligard, would you care to introduce your bill and talk about it?
I sure would. Can you hear me?
I can, yes, I'm sure we can.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair in committee. You know, the bill before you that we're discussing is a grant of $3.8 million to the Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority to expand a city-owned building housing for a solar manufacturer. But before I begin, I would just like to start by everyone on the committee and everyone at the Capitol and everyone across the state of Minnesota knows how proud and passionate I am about the history and traditions of the Iron Range regarding mining. But with that said, and it's always been said, that the Iron Range needs to diversify its economy, and rightfully so. And the project before us right now that you're viewing is exactly that. And when I had the opportunity to bring up the freshman class to see it, feel it, and touch it on the Iron Range, and both Democrat and Republican, I was able to take him to this facility, and I was extremely proud to do so. This project before you is one that is going to help diversify the Iron Range and bring about a high quality of jobs. And not only does it do that, it is the only solar manufacturer in the state of Minnesota, made right, made here in Minnesota. And I'm extremely proud of that. And in Helene, as a company, is exceptional. They're known for a quality project and a quality product that delivers to their customers, from large-scale commercial solar systems to the U.S. Department of Defense. And they also have helped in SpaceX. And Helene has invested millions of dollars in high-tech equipment and made capital investment to make this factory successful in Minnesota. And I am proud to say that it is bursting at the seams. It's employing 85 people. It's soon going to go to 95 people, four shifts, operating three shifts a day for 7 days a week here on the Iron Range, where these jobs are extremely needed. And I'm also proud to say they started off at 20 megawatts a year, and now they are at 150 megawatts a year. And with this new investment, about a total of about $30 million in equipment and an expansion and all of that, they will increase from 150 megawatts a year to 350 megawatts a year right here in Minnesota, producing 2,800 solar panels coming out of Mountain Iron, the heart of the Iron Range. And when we talk about diversification, what a better project is this when we're going into renewable energy. And we're talking about solar, and we're talking about all of that, and we're doing it right here in Minnesota. And this grant will help leverage both private in public investment through the city of Aurora. I mean, excuse me, through the city of Mountain Iron to make this successful. And today I have two testifiers, Greg Wainio and then Martine, the CEO of the facility, Helene, and they can answer any questions. But for me, being passionate about mining, me also being passionate about diversifying the economy on the Iron Range, this project to me is at a very, very high level and for what it brings to our region in this time of need. So I could stand for any questions, but I just wanted to share that with you. And I believe that I have two testifiers that can answer any of the technical questions or the fiscal questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde. I think we would like to hear from the CEO of Helene, Martin Hotaruk. And I hope I got the name close. And if not, you're going to let me know.
Yes, Martin is enough. Thank you. That's why nobody mentions the last name. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record. I'm Martin Hotaruk, the CEO of Helene. The company has been in business for 10 years last month. And we have been in Mountain Iron since May of 2017. As Representative Liz Lagarde just mentioned, July payroll was 85. August payroll next Tuesday is going to be 95 employees, and we're increasing 10 more by the end of September. So by the end of September, 105. The payroll in the last 12 months has been 2 million. The payroll for the year 2020 is going to be around 2.3 million. With this project, we're going to be able to build a new building. This new building will host a warehouse. We have been using an existing building that was built 9 years ago that is rather very small. And for that reason, we're using a temporary warehouse, which is a tent, and a temporary warehouse that we're renting in the city of Minneapolis. The new building will therefore be used as a warehouse, as well as host the next manufacturing line. The next manufacturing line will add another 35 employees and bring payroll from 2.3 million to 3.5 million a year. At a high level and in a nutshell, that is what the project is about. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see questions right now, so we will go on to the city administrator of Mountain Iron, Greg Wainio.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Craig Wainio. I'm the city administrator for the city of Mountain Iron and also the executive director for the Mountain Iron EDA, which owns the building that Helene is now housed in. We started this process back in the mid-2000s in a comprehensive plan update. We identified it as one of the areas we wanted to focus on was clean and renewable energy for our community, for development, and for our residents. Out of there, we participated in the Green Step Cities program. We were one of the first ones up on the Iron Range up in this area to participate in that. We're part of Seoul Smart City. We were one of the first organizations to install solar panels up here at our community center. And out of all of that, we came up with the idea of a renewable and sustainable energy park, which we developed with the help of the state, the local, and the IRRRB to develop this park to house potential renewable and sustainable energy businesses. From there, we did, in diversifying, we did a land in 2010, a solar manufacturer to this facility. For various reasons, that didn't work out. We were lucky enough to come across Helene and have them take over the facility and the development of the solar panels there, the building of the solar panels. As Martine said, right now there's 85 employees. We have a nice, very bright staff up there. I met the general manager, Joanne, She's very good. We've also got an MIT engineer up there, which I never thought we would see that up in Mountain Iron so much, but it's nice to see those kind of talented people coming up to our area. The building is owned by the EDA, like I said. Martine and Halian are paying over $50,000 a year in property taxes on that building that go into the local coffers of the state, county, and schools and the city. He is also making lease payments of $101,000 a year. With this project, those lease payments will increase as we pay back because one of the participants in this project is the IRRRB, who will provide us a non-recourse loan for a portion of this project. And from there, we would pay them back from the lease payments from Helene. But our commitment is to solar. We're in the process of developing a 2.4 megawatt solar installation right near the plant. Mount Iron operates its own electric utility, and therefore we're developing a utility type scale solar installation. So I think that Mount Iron has taken great steps in trying to diversify the economy here on our with our partners. And this is a very important project and a very very necessary project to continue that process. We know that it's not the end. This is probably just the beginning, because as this technology and this area continues to grow, we want to be a part of it. So thank you very much, Madam Chair. And if there's any questions, I'll certainly answer.
Representative Swazinski has a question. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this message or this question would just kind of be in general. So there's 85 employees at this facility. It's owned by the EDA. It sounds like they pay about $100,000 a year. That would potentially go up. Is the total cost of the project $3.8 million?
Martin Pachtarek responding. No, the building is estimated right now at $6.5 million. That's why Mr. Wainio said that the disposable funding that we're applying for will pay for 50% of the cost of the building, while the IRRB will contribute with the other 50%. That's for the building alone. Then the company will invest on the equipment plus the working capital. The equipment is estimated at $5 million, and the working capital requirement to run this facility is $25
million. Representative Swazinski.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So the IRRB will be paying for half, and then this bill would potentially pay for the other half of that building for the RDA.
All right.
Thank you. So, is the expansion going to be particularly dependent on this money, or will they expand regardless of whether or not they receive the money from the IRRB or the state of Minnesota, or from the RDA?
Yes, Martin, if you could respond.
Right now, the expansion is contingent on this possible funding. If this funding would not be available, then, you know, we'll need to look for alternatives.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, will the business create these jobs someplace else if this money is not in other parts of the state, or will they just not create them?
We will look for other sources of funding similar to the IRRB. We're not considering moving. We would be inefficient for the business to run factories in two different places. So we have, you know, engineering, quality assurance, other services, if we can call it that way, from staff that are already placed based in Mountain Iron. Therefore, if we were to set up a factory in North Carolina or in New Mexico, then we will need to duplicate that. Therefore, that is not what we would like to do unless, you know, we're forced to do that.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, why would you be forced to do that and have those jobs go to North Carolina? what's the difference between Minnesota and North Carolina?
There are no differences. That's why we're focused on setting up a manufacturing facility in Mountain Iron. We're trying to find a solution for the fact that there are no buildings available in Mountain Iron. Therefore, we need to build a building in Mountain Iron.
Madam Chair, if I may.
I don't know who is responding.
Representative Lislegarde.
Representative Lislegarde, yes.
So I, you know, in some of my remarks, I should have stated that if you do a tour, which, you know, Senator Osmick came and others, their warehouse is great big tents. There's nowhere for them to go. There is efficiencies issues, and we have winter. So when you have a great big plastic tent, and it's big, two of them, and that's where you're storing all of your equipment in your warehouse, there's nowhere to expand to create these efficiencies so you can be competitive around the United States and in the globe. So this investment, there will be a rate of return by the ability to expand, create jobs for the region.
Thank you, Representative Lislegarde. Is that it? Representative Swazinski, Representative Baker is next up. I didn't hear a response. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've worked on the RDA fund and things for some time, and I always recall that this fund was very specific to benefiting XL rate customers that participate and fund this thing, as well as the Prairie Island Indian community. My question may be to Representative Lislegarde or, again, others that are on this. And by the way, congratulations on your fabulous expansion. I'm really glad you guys are doing very, very well up there in Mountain Iron. This is wonderful news. But I think we have to make sure this falls within the purview of what our bill can do. So my question to Representative Lislegarde, how can this or how will this, any expenditures are supposed to benefit XL ratepayers or the Prairie Island community? So how does that fit in our expenditure of this should this go forward?
Representative Lislegarde.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, well, that's not entirely true. There have been other expenditures outside of the XL territory, and I don't know all the details, but I did do some research on that. So there has been stuff in I believe Colorado and Iowa or somewhere like that. So it is specific to renewable energies and stuff like that. But I would like just to remind you that when we talk about that, so first of all, it has went other places. But secondly, I go back to education. We all care about education. Well, the Iron Range, Mountain Iron in particular, because that's the largest base, we pay $41 per child for every student in the state of Minnesota. And we look at that and we say, we care about education. So we're willing to make that investment no matter where it goes in the state of Minnesota. And the same thing with this, you do not have to spend it totally in the XL Energy. Is that what the preferred is? Yes. But when you have a viable project exactly like this, the only solar manufacturer in the state of Minnesota and the upper Midwest that is bursting at the seams, creating jobs, creating tax base, and you have to make a $3.8 million investment and it meets the criteria, that is the perfect investment at the perfect time in the perfect region with the perfect message. Made right, made in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Lislegarde.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up on that.
Yes.
Maybe ask Mr. Evans from XL or maybe Mr. Eloff. Representative Lislegarde mentioned a few other projects that were not in Minnesota, but I want to know, is this something to the folks that kind of really know the statutes well, is this something that would be a legal expenditure in this current bill state?
I think that's a question for counsel. Mr. Eloff.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, the
the language that's being referred to in section 116C.779, which is where the renewable development account is established, is as follows. Expenditures from the fund must benefit Minnesota ratepayers receiving electric service from Xcel or the Prairie Island Indian community or its members. But you'll note at line, the first words of this bill are notwithstanding that statute's paragraph J, which indicates that requirement does not need to be met in this case. So using the containing that language that allows this expenditure to occur.
All right. Thank you for the update.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Long and then Representative Mahoney. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a very brief comment I was on the freshman tour going up with Representative Lissigard to see the plant and Helene, and just wanted to say it's very impressive, and we're very excited to have Helene in Minnesota manufacturing solar panels here, and very excited that you all are expanding your operations and doing well in the state. So that was my comment.
Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to Representative Baker's comments about the money. I am always uncomfortable when RDA money is taken outside of the Xcel Energy ratepayers service area. And this actually, this bill probably has to go to, if I would be more comfortable with this bill in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, because it makes a good case for support and for support through the economic development area rather than through the RDA. But that's really my only comment to this particular bill, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't, just a minute. I don't see any other questions or comments. Representative Lissigard, would you like to make a few closing comments before we go on to the next bill?
Yeah, sure. I appreciate all the questions, but it is just amazing how hard it is for us on the Iron Range to go to work. And, you know, that's all we're trying to do is to create opportunity for our families, you know, to put food on the table and, you know, contribute to society in a way that enhances people's lives. And so I would appreciate any support we can get, both Democrat and Republican. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lissigard. We're going to go on now to House File 4365. Representative Backer, that is your bill. Would you like to introduce it and then introduce also your testifiers? Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lewiginius, for the opportunity to present this bill and ask members to support this project that we have with the University of Minnesota Morris. This is an existing opportunity in West Central Minnesota, which has had a long line of innovative energy projects taken by the University of Minnesota. This bill does ask for $5.2 million from the Xcel Renewable Development Account, as most people know, is RDA. This funding will leverage a much larger dollar amount from other non-state sources, as detailed that we will see from the presenters. The ammonia production pilot project is appropriate use of RDA funds, as it will demonstrate new uses for unique renewable energy and energy storage technology. The RDA funding is a one-time appropriation and will be used as matching money. Again, thank you, Chair Wagenius, for this opportunity, and I do turn this over to our presenters. Thank you.
Well, the first presenter is Mike Reese, University of Minnesota Morris. Mr. Reese, if you would begin.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius, and thank you, members. I'd also like to thank Representative Backer for carrying this bill on behalf of the University of Minnesota. Bill is HF 4365, Ammonia Production Pilot Demonstration. I would like to direct your attention to the presentation that we provided for your packet, as we'll be talking about that. So one of the key aspects of renewable energy generation is the ability to be able to store it and store it efficiently. Prices of wind and solar are declining every day, it seems, is it like, and being able to use the excess power efficiently and effectively is a key part of that. And so I'll direct your attention to the second slide. The University of Minnesota is a global research leader in the field of producing and utilizing renewable ammonia for energy storage. We began this work back in 2013 when we established the first wind-to-ammonia pilot plant in the world. And from that, we have worked with colleagues across the University of Minnesota to further make this technology more efficient and to utilize ammonia as energy storage. The nice part about ammonia and compared to batteries is that it is very flexible. It can be used for fertilizer. It can be used for fuel, as we've demonstrated and developed technology to do that, and tractors, but it also could be used for energy storage. And the energy storage part of it is particularly attractive because it provides an opportunity for long-term seasonal storage, as opposed to batteries, where when you store it, you need to use it within a very short time frame. It is also more cost-effective than battery or hydrogen alone technologies alone. So when you look at the benefits of ammonia as regional scale energy storage, it provides both distribution and transmission scale energy storage. There's a wide range of fuel uses. You could use it in internal combustion engine gensets, turbines, fuel cells, and also use it for thermal energy. And you could either use it directly as ammonia or crack it back into hydrogen. You have seasonal storage capability. You can stabilize the grid with ammonia. It's readily dispatchable generation capacity. Peak load and peak fertilizer months are complementary. And so in Minnesota, we can both use it for nitrogen fertilizer, but also use it for energy storage. So in utilities call this shoulder seasons when nitrogen fertilizer is used. And so they would not have demand for it and vice versa. In May, when we're putting fertilizer on in October, or excuse me, May and June, and then into October and November, utilities don't necessarily have high loads at that point in time, or at least peaks. It enables utilization of excess generation of wind, solar, and nuclear power that can be low priced and even negatively priced across the independent system operator system. Provides emergency backup outside of traditional energy sources. So if you think back to the polar vortex, when natural gas was extremely constrained, here we have instances where we have energy storage across Minnesota, or ammonia storage across Minnesota, that could be tapped for emergency power. There's a flexibility between renewable and non-renewable generation. We can start by using the brown ammonia and then switch over time to green ammonia, very similar to what we have done with our electric grid. Significant levels of ammonia storage already in place in the Midwest, and usually they're near significant distribution and transmission lines as well as industrial load. And then we also have multiple avenues of synthesis. Our focus is on using electricity, but ammonia, renewable ammonia, can also be produced from methane from manure or gasification. I'd like to draw your attention now to slide 4. As I'm getting it pulled up here as well. Large-scale ammonia storage is already in place across Minnesota. I'm showing you a picture of the Glenwood CF Industries ammonia terminal. It holds 60,000 tons of anhydrous ammonia, which is would be equivalent to 111,000 megawatt hours of electricity. Wind and solar PV are in close proximity. There's a CapEx 500 kV line in close proximity, and it's a hub for wind energy transmission. If you look at the map that I provided of Minnesota, the yellow stars, which are located at Barnesville, Glenwood, Murdoch, Rosemount, and Vernon Center, indicate these same levels of storage capacity already in place. And in many respects, they're underutilized because they're utilized primarily for nitrogen fertilizer. So those storage facilities could be used to store wind and solar power as well. Now I'd like to turn the presentation over to my colleague. We'll allow him to introduce himself.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee and complement what my dear colleague Mike Rees has just discussed. My name is Prodromos Dautidis, and I am a professor and executive officer in the Department of Chemical Engineering and Material Science at the University of Minnesota. My group, for the last 5 to 6 years, studies the economics of renewable ammonia, its regional deployment, and its use as a centerpiece of sustainable agriculture. And what I'm here to talk about today is about ammonia as a storage medium. This is a prospect that has received worldwide attention, literally, and we are among the very few groups that have studied its economic feasibility. And I'm here to provide a summary of some of the results that we have come up with. So we have considered an energy supply system which uses renewables for 16 different locations in the United States with different climates and demand profiles, including Minnesota. And we have proposed the design of a system that will minimize the levelized cost of energy storage by choosing technologies for renewable generation, storage options, and conversion back to power. And slide 5 in the deck that we have distributed beforehand shows a comparison between batteries, hydrogen, and a combined hydrogen and ammonia system for 3 different locations in the United States, including Minneapolis. And as you can see, as expected, batteries are very expensive, especially when we consider long storage options. So they are not really a viable option to store renewable electricity over a long term. If you look at the next slide that we have provided, slide 6 provides a few more details and the cost breakdown on the costs of using hydrogen or a mixture of hydrogen and ammonia for storage. And as you can see, the levelized cost of energy storage ranges between 15 to 20 cents per kilowatt hour. 15 is for Minneapolis. And this includes renewable generation infrastructure, which actually contributes more than 50% to the overall cost, which means that the cost would be even less if that infrastructure were already in place. It's also apparent from this graph that the incorporation of ammonia as a way to store energy is advantageous. And let me explain a little bit why this is the case. We have hydrogen. Hydrogen is the least dense of all elements. Therefore, we need high pressure to store it, and therefore we need expensive materials to build the storage infrastructure. On the other hand, we have ammonia. Ammonia is liquid at moderate pressure and ambient temperature, and therefore it is much easier to store and can also be transported. Of course, in order to make ammonia, you need hydrogen. So you lose some efficiency in terms of going from ammonia to power versus what you would have if you had just hydrogen to power. So this is precisely the trade-off that is best exploited by a combination of hydrogen and ammonia as a way to store energy. And you can see that in the next slide that we have provided, slide number 7, which gives you some typical profiles of storage and generation over a year in Minneapolis. As you can see, both hydrogen and ammonia are used for storage as well as for power generation, but they do so in a very different way. Hydrogen captures smaller amounts and it's used for faster generation of power, ammonia is larger amounts and it's used for seasonal storage that captures these long-term characteristics of the storage. So this is exactly why ammonia is such a great option to address renewable intermittency for seasonal or long-term storage. So to recap, we're extremely honored to have Minnesota being a leader in this field. Literally, these are efforts that were initiated by Mike Reese and the Chemical Engineering and Material Science Department at Minnesota, one of the top departments in the world, has joined this effort wholeheartedly. We have a very promising technology. We have the opportunity to bring in substantial additional funds in order to build a demonstration facility in Minnesota. And I hope that we will have your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm checking for, I don't see raised hands, but let me then ask Mr. Reese this question. I reviewed your slides beforehand, and it was not clear to me for this particular proposal. You're obviously ammonia can be used for fertilizer, and that's in the shoulder seasons, and you're talking about storage in the winter and summer, but I don't understand which, in this particular project, what's the, how much of this money is going to go for storage versus how much of the money is going to go for the production of nitrogen for farms?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To address your question, I'd like to refer to the final three slides or the final two slides, slide 8 and slide 9. This request is to be used for matching funds for a federal grant. The grant is through the U.S. Department of Energy Refuel Program, and the Refuel Program's goal is to promote and develop ammonia, green ammonia, for use as energy storage. So for this particular case, that 100% of the funds will be used to pursue ammonia as energy storage. And we are in a very good position because of our past work in this, which did start with nitrogen fertilizer. However, the market now is primarily moving towards, at least initially, using ammonia for energy storage. I just saw an article from Business Wire where the market for green ammonia in 2019 was $17 million, and it's projected to be $852 million in 2030, of which primarily will be used for power generation. And so I think that's the key message here, is that it is flexible, but for this proposal, we are primarily looking and 100% looking at uses energy storage. And I'll point your attention to slide number 9. This is the team that we are putting together to apply for this Department of Energy project. So if you look at that, we have some of the major technology leaders, including Nel, which is a electrolyzer manufacturer, world-leading electrolyzer manufacturer, Casale, who is a world-leading ammonia technology company, the Research Triangle Institute in North Carolina, who is leading in terms of developing catalysts as well as pilot facilities. And then obviously on the right-hand side, you see the end users. And we've had very good conversations with Xcel Energy, Great River Energy, CF Industries, and other companies within Minnesota. And I don't want to speak for them, but I'll say in general, those conversations have been very positive about this technology.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And it's more of a comment. I wanted to thank Representative Backer and all the folks in Morris. I know Representative Backer knows that I'm a big fan of not only the city of Morris, but the university's work on renewables. I teach a class at the U of M here in the Twin Cities, and we go up every year, a field trip up to Morris to really look at what they're doing there. And so I have a lot of faith and confidence in this project. I especially, you know, wanted to compliment the folks up there for the anaerobic digestion research that they're doing. And I think this complements that very well. You know, really, the link between renewable energy and agriculture is more important than ever. So thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a very worthwhile project. And Madam Chair, while I'm here and have the floor, I think, you know, there is a theme running through all of the three bills that we've heard today. And that is there's tremendous potential for lots of good paying jobs in the clean energy industry. And, you know, between, you know, all three of these projects are unique and you know, we have energy efficiency in buildings with Representative Lee's bill, you know, Representative Listlegard is talking about the incredible economic potential for solar. And now we have this research project at the U of M. So they all are deserving of funding. You know, we can, of course, look at and debate the sources of that funding. But just as the other forms of energy have received public backing in the past, you know, the renewable forms and energy efficiency that we're talking about this morning, Madam Chair, are also very worthy of public support. And so I hope that we will, you know, move forward with that as these more dirty forms of energy we phase out, and certainly we phase out of their public support. We should be, you know, focusing on public support for these bills. So thank you very much for Representative Backer. And also, I don't know if Representative Listlegard or Lee are still on, but I wanted to thank and compliment them for their efforts as well.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Members, any other comments? We are close to adjourning, but Representative Backer, I see you're still with us. And if you'd like to give us some closing comments on the bill that you have introduced. Representative Backer. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Wagenius. Appreciate that. Just to let you know, Senator Westrom has also been a champion of this bill. I know Mr. Reese and the Senator has worked really well, and I've been able to work alongside with them on that. So I do appreciate this opportunity to share an asset that we have in West Central Minnesota. Thank you so much for the consideration to me.
Okay. Members, any other questions before I am moving to adjournment? I don't see any. I appreciate the testifiers today. I share Representative Hornstein's enthusiasm for bills that put us on a new track or on a positive track with regard to renewable energy jobs. So thank you for those comments, Representative Hornstein. And with that, we will adjourn this meeting. Thank you all so much.